Hey everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan, and I appreciate you being here. I just finished a very, very interesting conversation with Matt Hill of Start9. Start9 provides sovereign computing solutions, specifically hardware, and we spent, I'd say, the first half or so of the discussion talking specifically about Start9 and sovereign computing and what it means. All really good takeaways I think you'll have. But I would highly encourage you to stick around for the back half of the discussion where Matt gets into his background and his journey into sort of libertarian capitalist ideals. It is so interesting, and I love some of the points he made about just simply opting out of the existing system, whether it's education or food or money. There are so many ways that we have the power of doing so today, and we just need to take advantage of it. Again, I think you're going to love this conversation with Matt. All righty. Like I said in the intro, I've got Matt here. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'm excited for this conversation. I'm actually a client of yours, I think you guys are doing some really important things, but I want to understand better, I think, what the overall mission is. Before we jump into the background of the company, if you go to start9.com, which I encourage everyone to do, check out the stuff you're working on. It says Start9, sovereign computing. Could you describe what you mean by sovereign computing, and how is it different from the way that most of the world is engaging with technology today?
Sure. I'll just sort of start with the word sovereign, which is a word that gets thrown around a lot and I think has a relatively agreed upon meaning, but with some nuance. So what I mean, and we mean when we say the word sovereign, is that you are in control, that you have power, that you are not dependent on or beholden to another to do the things that you want to do or to satisfy your needs. This essentially means that you are independent and in control. And a derivative of that is privacy. When you are independent and in control, you can choose to be private or you can choose to be public. But privacy is actually a derivative of sovereignty, in our opinion. So that's why we went with sovereign computing as opposed to private computing, because it's actually a broader concept. It's not just about privacy. It's about control. It's about, ownership and censorship resistance and all the rest. So sovereign computing means that it's a computing paradigm in which the individual or the family or the business, whoever owns the computer, is in total control of that physical device, all the information that flows through it, and all of the data that is stored on it, that you are in total control of the entire experience of interacting with your computers. And at scale, this means all sorts of computers, right? This, like, your laptop, for instance, and your phone are not the only computers in your lives. Increasingly, your car is a computer, and your thermostat is a computer, and your refrigerator is a computer. Everything will be a computer at some point, right? Like every real world object, not everything, I'm exaggerating, but most real world objects will be digital in some way. They will be linked up in some way, or at least we hope, because that is the most intelligent world possible. And so we believe that individuals, families, businesses, whatever entity at whatever scale, should be in total control of all of those physical devices, meaning that they are not forced to pay for them on a monthly basis, because that means you don't own them. Nobody else can turn them off. Nobody else can use them without your permission. In fact, nobody else even knows that they exist unless you choose to share their existence with the world. And so that's what we mean by sovereign computing, is a proliferation of smart devices, laptops, cell phones, all the way to thermostats and everything in between, that are under the total sovereign, independent control of their owners.
So in general, my sense is that your target market today is primarily individuals. Is that fair to say? Or do you work with a lot of, or do you engage with many businesses? And if so, what's sort of their compelling use case versus, is it just they want to do things right? Or, because it's so convenient to trust Microsoft or Google with, you know, storage of photos or storage of your documents or any sort of important information. It's convenient, but obviously there are trade-offs. To what extent are businesses beginning to think this way?
So you're right in that our primary customer at the moment is individuals, but also families. We are widely used by families. For instance, my family has a server, and we all have, you know, user accounts on the various services or applications that are running on that server. So it's very useful for families today. It is not as useful for businesses yet. And that is because of, you know, a couple of features that are lacking, not because the paradigm itself is incompatible with the business use case. It's just because the product isn't there yet. But it has been a focus of ours in our development efforts and will be business compatible in the near future. In fact, we have some announcements coming later this year related to the business use case that we think will be very welcomed. The two features that have been lacking, namely, are ClearNet access. This means the ability to host your services on ClearNet domains such that you, your employees, your vendors, your partners, and your customers can access these web resources using a normal browser entering a normal mybusiness.com domain. Because businesses, unlike individuals, cannot relegate their digital existence to, you know, the local area network, VPNs, and Tor. They have to meet their customers and their partners and their employees and their vendors where they're at. And where they're at is the normie public internet. And so businesses need this feature to be able to host the things that they install on ClearNet. This will be possible in the next release of StartOS. It will be easy two releases from now. So we're on our way to making ClearNet really plug and play, which has been kind of a dream of many people for many years, to automate the process of hosting, getting certificates, you know, port forwarding, setting up firewalls. It's all this like huge black box of skill and mystery. And a lot of people for many years have wanted to automate and streamline that. And we really have figured it out. We just haven't completed building it yet, but we do know how to do it. And it's going to be really, really convenient for businesses. Or individuals too, families. You could host your stuff on ClearNet as well. That's one feature. The second feature that's been lacking is automatic scheduled remote encrypted backups. StartOS already has the concept of encrypted backups, but you have to trigger them. You have to plug in a drive, or you have to connect your server to a device on the network and click backup. You have to physically, you know, go into the UI, click create backup, wait for it to backup, unplug the drive, and put it somewhere safe. And while that works and is tolerable, especially for a lot of, you know, dedicated or motivated individuals, businesses can't be bothered with that. They're very much like, I just want my backups created automatically. I want to make sure they're in 10 different places so that if anything goes wrong, I'm back up and running in a moment's notice without missing a beat. And I don't want to have to think about that. And so we have remote automatic encrypted backups coming along with the easy ClearNet 2 releases from now. So once those two features are here, we will be business ready, so to speak. And a business would use our product, many of them primarily to save money, right? Software subscriptions are becoming an increasingly important cost center for CFOs in this world. Like, it's not trivial anymore. It used to be, but you are on a monthly basis now as a business of say 20 employees, right? If your business is 20 people, you're spending up to $10,000 a month on software subscriptions. That is a meaningful number. And not only are you spending this amount of money on a monthly basis, but you are entrusting and custodying all of your company's information, all your company's data with these third-party SaaS providers. So you're sort of getting double whammied here. You're getting charged and you're getting spied on, exposed, and you're lowering your cybersecurity footprint, because eventually these third-party servers are going to get hacked and all of your company data is going to get leaked. And so more and more, we're seeing demand from businesses to not only save money on software subscriptions, but also to take back control over their company, employee, customer, and vendor information, because it's not safe on these third-party servers.
Got it. So the exposure shifts from, so if you're a small business, you own some office space and you have, like, my dad used to own a small software company. And I remember prior to like the migration to the cloud, they had a little server room and they hosted their own web application there. And I have no idea what the backup process was or anything. I'm sure it was, I'm sure that latency issues and, just like the time online all got better when they went to the cloud, but they gave up a lot of, they exposed themselves, obviously. Fortunately for them, there wasn't a lot of sensitive data collected. It was just a web application. They collected email address and names of folks that they worked with, and that was about it. But I guess what I'm trying to figure out then is the exposure shifts from, well, Google or Microsoft is a honeypot, to you have to like drive into the parking lot of, you know, in some way, like meaningfully attack that business versus attack this large honeypot. And you kind of find out whose data you get once you get in there and break it. Is that what it is? Is like, you've got to really focus on attacking a small business and choose that small business, which you kind of gain some security through obscurity. Like, no one knows who you are anyway, so why would they waste their time on you when Google or Microsoft or some of these big companies exist? Is that sort of the trade-off? Because you're still exposed, right? Like, there's still a chance that your network being broken, your servers being accessed through some means, but you lose the honeypot effect. Is that kind of it?
Yeah. So I'll put that in slightly different language. You know, there is a sort of quantitative differences between degrees of cybersecurity, right? Like, mm-hmm. you're doing all the right things or you're not doing any of the right things. But there's also these qualitative differences, okay? So when you custody your data with a third party, along with everyone else, you're in one category of security. Now you have to optimize for security within that category, which largely means, you know, petitioning that company to do better data security practices, which is often done through politicians, which results in laws, which results in higher expense, which ends up getting charged to you, and they get hacked anyway, because hacking is a matter of social engineering, not breaking encryption. Right. Right? A lot of people think that hacking takes place from, like, you know, hackers sort of battling each other on the keyboard. It's not. Hacking takes place at the bar, right? Hacking takes place through seduction, bribery, force, you know, extortion, you name it, blackmail. And so eventually these servers will get hacked. When you do not put your data on a third-party server, you're now in a different category of security, right? You are now responsible for protecting your own data, but nobody is attacking the server because it's not a honeypot. It's not attractive. One, somebody would have to know that you're doing this, first of all. They would have to know that you're running your own server. Two, they would have to know physically where the server is. Three, they would have to be sufficiently motivated to attack the server, meaning they believe that you have something on that server that is of immense value, because every server has something of minor value. But to risk life and liberty, you're going after something, you know, of value. You're not just going to go rob some barbershop's server down the street, because you're not going to get anything out of it, but you are risking your freedom. And so the server is essentially safe because the risk reward doesn't add up for attackers in most cases. In some cases, a business may have extremely valuable data on their servers, such as private keys to a Lightning node, for instance, in which case you need to secure that server. The last thing you should do is run your Lightning node. The last thing that you should do under that awareness is choose to run your Lightning node on someone else's server, because now you're just saying, look, it's too hard to keep my server secure, so I'm just going to give it away to begin with. I'm just going to give it to this other company to begin with and black out the fact that they now control my money, and that if that they could, one, take it, and two, if they get hacked, it's gone anyway. So it's strictly worse to custody sensitive data with a third party than it is with yourself. But there are additional measures that you can take as a business to secure your server. You don't just have to hide it in the office, right? You had mentioned the word cloud and then the word, like, you know, self-hosting, as though they're mutually exclusive opposites.
And that's not quite the right way to think about it. When you run your own server, you're still using the cloud. You're using your cloud. Mm-hmm. So the question is, what does cloud mean? Cloud just means a server located somewhere that you access from multiple clients, right? So why not put it somewhere super safe? Why not put your personal cloud somewhere safe? There are businesses in every city, every major city of this country in the US, where you can pay a monthly fee to get rack space in a server room that is locked in a bunker with a security guard out front. And nobody in the world has to know that you have your server there, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're a business and you're like, I have sensitive shit on my server, one, I don't want anyone to know I'm running a server. Two, I don't want them to know where the server is. And three, if they do know where the server is, I want them to have to fight through locked doors and armed guards. Then you can pay a small fee to put your server in somebody else's bunker with security on-prem and do it anonymously such that nobody knows it's even your server down there.
And that's, is that like infrastructure as a service? Is, would that be like the...
Yeah. I mean, it's yeah, correct. Because it's not even their computer. You're bringing your physical computer to this location, plugging it in. So it's your computer. You're literally just paying for a shelf with an internet, with a 99.999% internet connection.
Got it.
Which is awesome. So,
yeah. That's interesting because I've got a personal problem that I want to talk to you about. So that way, maybe you can sort of share as an example, like how Start9 would make this work. But my issue with it's like access. So for example, my Bitcoin node went down the other day. I think it was I just need to reset it and I'll have access to it. It's not like a hardware issue or anything. But like if I'm out of town and I want to access documents on my home server, right? Like I want to remotely access documents and it's down, like what's my means of, you know, internet went out, a tree fell on the power line, you know, like whatever the case may be. I think this hosting or buying the rack space somewhere else makes a lot of sense because they're not going to go. There's backup generators. There's all sorts of, there's not a single point of failure on almost anything that those businesses have. Plus you get armed security and all of that.
Nothing extrinsic to the server. Now the server can always have an issue, right? So the internet could be fine. The power could be fine, but the drive could fail or something like that.
Yeah. And that's where you need redundancy of hardware.
Correct. At some point, servers need physical maintenance, period. There's no server that has ever existed that at some point in its history did not need a human to touch it to make it work again. Okay. Yeah. So there is always the scenario where you're going to be away and for some unknown reason or another, the server is offline and you're going to either need you or someone you trust to go check it out and see what's going on. That is far less likely to happen in a hosting facility that is, you know, dedicated to keeping power and internet online.
Got it.
Man, that's the most common reason is internet and power issues, which happens at residences far more than a facility like that.
Yeah. No, that's something I really need to think about because, you know, for my node to go down or something like that, whatever. But if I'm gone and I need to access important documents for a particular reason or for work or whatever, I need to make sure that the availability is high.
Well, part of that is a matter of redundancy. So not data redundancy, but load balancing, this idea of horizontal scaling, right? So that you essentially have a server in this part of the world and a server in this part of the world, and they are effectively functioning as the same server. And depending on where you are and how much traffic is coming in and how the health status of either of these servers, one or the other will be used at any given moment, but it doesn't matter to you because they're essentially synchronizing and they're the same thing. And that is what, you know, large companies do. They don't just have one server in one bunker. They have, you know, multiple around the world. And there's no reason that individuals, families, and businesses cannot copy that same pattern, but we have not built that feature yet. That's not something that is offered by StartOS or Start9 at this time, but it is something that we have talked about and intend to do. It's just a very hard problem to solve. It's not easy to do.
So right? Down the road, in your perfect world, I could buy two Start9 servers and I could send, like, I live in St. Louis, we're sort of close to a fault line. So I'm like, hey, like the odds of something happening could be it's non-zero, right? And something going down. And you know, you're my friend and you're in Denver. I could send you another start nine and we could, again, this is down the road, sync it up to where I trust you. You're not going to tamper with it. You're not going to do anything with it. But if my line goes down, it kicks over to the start nine device in Denver and I can still access anything anywhere.
Yeah, correct. That's kind of would be completely your server in that scenario. You'd never want to share a server with someone. Or I shouldn't say never, but that is a far, you know, less common case that I would expect to see. But you could position servers in a variety of places such that you're, you know, you become sort of invincible. You know, if one goes down, the other picks up the slack and you don't lose a beat. And then eventually you get to the server that went down and you fix it up and you're, you know, you're back up to 100%. But, you know, that's added effort for people to like position servers in various parts of the world. Or to be honest, it doesn't even need to be in various parts of the world. Like, let's be real. Most people don't need global redundancy. What they need is one in their home and one in a bunker at the hosting facility down the street. And you're good to go. Like, that's going to take care of you for 99.99% of cases.
Unless you've got something truly mission, like this probably isn't individuals. Like if you're a business, you know, with some sort of specialty service that you're, you know, you're servicing the federal government and they need you on call at any time or access, you know, but that's sort of those unique one-offs.
Sure. Well, there's also a degree of like, I shouldn't say never, but we're probably never going to be a product for or attractive to large enterprises. Right. Because their needs are custom, their needs are massive, and they have the money to hire the talent and to pay for the resources to do this the old fashioned way, right? To roll these systems themselves or to use AWS if they don't care about that custodianship or whatever it is. You know, we are going to be attractive to small business. We are going to be attractive to the companies that have been left behind, the ones that are getting nickeled and dimed in ways that matter, the ones that do not have the funds or expertise to host their own servers, because we do make it possible and affordable, right? That's who's been left behind here. It's not Facebook. They're fine. Who's been left behind is, you know, the mom and pop shops all over the country that are paying hundreds and thousands of dollars a month and could, in a matter of days and minimal effort, switch their entire infrastructure over to their own server, barely miss a beat in terms of their daily operations and flows, because self-hosting with your own services, and we haven't really talked about this, is roughly equivalent to using third-party services in terms of convenience and user experience. It's not like it's once you're running your own server, now you're super techie and geeky and you know everyone has to learn new stuff. It's like once you make the transition, it's actually pretty much like it was before, right? Like I run almost my entire life on a couple of my own servers and, you know, I just take a picture and close my phone and what's happening behind the scenes is that it's getting encrypted and sent and stored on the server and shared in an album. And so my wife can see it and all the rest, but I don't know any of that, right? Like it's just, it feels the same as using Google Photos. So that's who we're going to be attractive to is these like, you know, the smaller entities of the world, families and small businesses up to about 100 employees.
Yeah. So, okay. So, hey, you brought up my problem. So my problem is that I quite foolishly, it's a matter of convenience. My whole family, immediate family and extended family, we use Apple shared photo albums. If, you know, we go on a trip together, we have a birthday, you know, whatever, we all share pictures there. And so I've got 5 years of my oldest daughter's photos that are mostly in a shared album in the cloud, in a cloud that I don't have ownership of. And I want to figure out a way to get those off and be self-sovereign. What is the, like, walk me through an example of, you know, how do I use Start9 to do that? And what's sort of the setup that you have, for example, and how might I think about that?
Sure. You're also being charged for that, the right to store your photos with Apple, right? I don't know what they're charging you monthly, but it's probably not nothing. Free tiers are getting smaller and smaller. So my setup is through Nextcloud. Nextcloud is a wonderful, massive, very mature piece of software that is run by massive businesses, enterprise, even governments run their infrastructure on Nextcloud. You can think about Nextcloud as Google Workspace. It's like the entire G suite of services. There's like... There's, you know, Docs, there's Drive, there's Photos, there's email, there's appointments and calendar, like all the things that an individual, a family, or a business would need to kind of like operate is Nextcloud, has all of it. It's the biggest, most important service on our store, you know, comparable to Bitcoin, serving a very different purpose. But like, I would identify those as probably the two biggest and most important services that we offer. And Nextcloud is kind of like Bitcoin's, you know, your money in decentralized consensus and money, but Nextcloud is everything else. And I use that loosely because there's lots of things that Nextcloud doesn't do in many places for other niche services. But Nextcloud is a huge chunk of it. And once you get it set up, which is not too hard, right? You click a button and it's installed on your server. And then you connect your clients, your phone, your laptop, your wife and family's phone and laptop and all that. And, you know, it's just like connecting your Google account on your phone. It's no different. You just create your account on the server. So you're actually like creating an account and logging into the server. So if you were running Nextcloud on your server, your friends and family, whoever you wanted to, would create accounts on that server. And you would permission them accordingly. You'd give them an allocation of drive space. You'd, you know, say they're an administrator, they're a user, like you can provision these users to make sure that they can't do anything, you know, too horrible in there. And then from that point on, users in the same organization on a Nextcloud instance can, you know, view each other's calendars if they want. You can share photo albums, you can share directories, folders in the drive. You can do appointments and you can do video chat just like this. Like I do almost all of my video chatting with my wife and her family and many meetings that I have at Start Nine. In fact, we do video chat through the server that's sitting in my living room. Now, most people can't do that yet with Start OS because video doesn't work too well over Tor. It gets really, you know, buggy and latency is very high. But I have Start OS running on ClearNet already because I'm special and I, you know, I'm dogfooding the product that we're eventually going to offer to everyone else. But it works really well already. I just had to sort of hack it in. It wasn't part of the above the water UX yet. But that's where we're going, is eventually you'll be able to do your phone calls, your video chats, all of it through this server that's just sitting in your living room. And what's cool is that the people with whom you are interacting, right? If you want to like share a photo album with somebody, or you want to do a video chat with somebody like this, they don't even need to know. Like when I schedule calls at Start Nine, I'll give somebody a link, which is like grab a time on my calendar. So they click the link, they browse the calendar, they select a time and they hit save. They then get an email that's like, okay, your appointment is booked, add it to your calendar. Here's the video chat link that you'll be using. And from their perspective, they just used Calendly, Google Calendar, and Zoom. They had no idea that this was a self-hosted server in my living room. And then they click the link, we get on the video chat, and I'm like, how was that experience? Was it smooth? And they were like, yeah, of course. You know, I basically just scheduled a time and now we're on a call. I was like, yeah, it's free. I eliminated Calendly, Zoom, and Google Calendar all in one swoop and you didn't even know, right? That's sort of the introduction of our business sales pitch, but it's not just businesses. I'm using that as a family right now. Like we do our video chats with family on our own server because I don't like the idea of Zoom just sort of watching us talk. It's weird.
Yeah, man, that is, you're making me think about all the possible ways I could be more sovereign. And I mean, you know, here's the thing. Most of my family or all of my family, no one's thinking about this stuff, right? And I think there's probably a level of awareness, and there's probably, we probably need enough people to experience some level of pain for loss of privacy to make this transition, right? I mean, I think right now you're able to use Google and it doesn't materially impact your life. Like you don't know, it's kind of unseen, any consequences or price that you're paying besides maybe the physical dollar cost of things, which I agree do seem to be going up. But for someone like myself, who is, you know, somewhat more privacy conscious and more disillusioned by what big tech is and represents, I think there are just so many things you're making me think about here. So yeah. What's the did you have something you wanted to add to that?
Yeah. So you're talking about sort of what's the motivation? What
What
is going to drive adoption of sovereign computing technology?
Yeah. Not just to Bitcoiners and cypherpunks.
Early adopters are early adopters for a reason. It's usually not just because, you know, there's a few people that are in it just for the sort of novelty. It's like, ooh, that's new and interesting. And those are geeks and hobby. Like, those are the techie geeks, right? And that's fine. Yeah. But early adopters who are using it for real, are doing it for a reason. Like, Bitcoiners are just ahead of the curve, right? Bitcoin opens a part of your brain. So does certain threads of anarchism and libertarianism, but Bitcoin does it really efficiently. It opens this part of your brain that's like, oh my God, it's all enclosed and entrapped, and we need to like figure out ways to do things ourselves, right? And so that's why, you know, Bitcoiners were the natural early adopters of StartOS and Start9's technologies. And what they see that others do not, and many of them don't see it fully even, and I'll list it for you right now. Here's the problems. There's four. There's exactly four problems with the existing computing infrastructure of Earth. One is invasion of privacy, right? This is the most obvious one that people leap to when they're like, should I use Google or not? They're like, Google's watching me. Google's spying on me. And in a way, this is actually not one of the most important things. It's just one of the most emotionally sensitive and obvious things, because in all likelihood, that's not going to bite you, right? The argument that most people give back to that is like, well, I have nothing to hide, so I don't really care, right? That's a very common retort. And in a way, those people are probably right. For most people in most countries, that's probably going to end up being correct. Like, you're never going to become an enemy of the state based on the text messages with your mother. Nobody cares. Nobody cares what you're talking about. You're not important. You're never going to be important. That is the reality for the vast majority of people in the vast majority of countries in this world. However, there are circumstances where that is blatantly incorrect. In fact, it's extremely dangerous to not have privacy. You do not know what the future holds. Having privacy now is an insurance policy against the future if the political winds change and all the things that you used to say and were fine are now held against you in a future timeline. So it's insurance more than it is a guarantee in the moment. Your privacy is also used against you in more subtle ways, such as like targeted advertisements and manipulation, right? Like, you, if every corporation in the country knows everything about you, then you can be subtly kind of manipulated into doing, believing, or purchasing things that you otherwise would not have. Other people like that part of it. They're like, they like having everything customized to them exactly, right? The product recommendations and the timelines and all that stuff. So that's one, and it's real and it's important. And that's the one everyone leaps to. Number two, is censorship. And this is an increasing one, right? This one is being talked about increasingly based on what has happened over the last 4 to 8 years, especially. And, you know, when everyone's using third-party servers, whoever runs those third-party servers decides what gets seen and what doesn't get seen. And that is rarely done through blatant deplatforming and more often achieved through algorithmic amplification or algorithmic dampening. Right. So it's like things that should be heard get amplified and things that should not get shadow banned. And so nobody even knows that this is happening, but it is happening literally all day, every day. This is like a common and pervasive form of censorship that takes place across all of social media. And as long as a few people are running those servers, that will continue. So that's number two. Number three is one that is becoming increasingly apparent, which is a good thing, because the first two are these dire things. The third one is cost. And, you know, while everything was free, people were kind of willing to even tolerate the first two. Like, yeah, there's some spying and there's some censorship, but it's super free and convenient, so I'm going to do it anyway. Even if they didn't like the first two, they were tolerating them for the benefits, the free benefits. And what's happening is those free tiers are getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and the paid tiers are getting steeper and steeper. And, sooner or later, every app on your phone is going to be $5 a month, $10 a month, and it's going to add up to a lot of money for a lot of people. And this is an inevitable trend in part because of the first one, privacy. So everyone's clamoring for privacy, right? What happens when an entire population clamors for privacy? Politicians, opportunistic politicians enter and they say, we will get you privacy. Vote for me and I'll make those tech giants keep your data private. So what they do is now they enforce all these rules and regulations on the tech giants to keep your data private, which does two things to the tech giants. One, it raises their cost of compliance, like their literal financial cost of complying with these laws and regulations. They have to hire people basically to do this. And two, they can't spy on you as well as they used to be able to. They can't just openly unrestricted mine your data and sell it to advertisers. They have to ask you now. They have to say, can we mine your data and sell it to advertisers? And you say no, which means they now lose revenue. So their costs went up and their revenues went down. How are they going to backfill that? How are they going to patch it? They're just going to charge you directly. They're just going to say, okay, well, now it's a monthly subscription. You took our ability to spy on you, so now we're going to charge you. So everything is going to get charged, which will make using them more painful. So that is a massive driver of adoption, or will be in the coming years as these costs continue to rise. And then the last one, which nobody thinks about except Bitcoiners, is the counterparty risk of data custodians. It's this idea of everyone honeypotting their data onto Google Photos. So when Google Photos stores the photos of everyone on Earth, that is a very attractive server to hack. Okay. Like if I'm a hacker, Google Photos is like my, you know, it's my white buffalo. I like want Google's server more than anything in the world. It's the most valuable server. Because if I get Google's server, not only do I get these photos of everyone, but I know all the people in their lives. I know their friends, their family, their significant others, their children. And there's a lot of people in this world that have photos on Google Photos that they don't want those people to see. Okay? Not everyone, but there's a lot of very innocent, well-meaning people in this world who have photos of whatever that they're just like, I wouldn't want my children to see that. And if I'm a hacker and I have those photos and I have your contact list, I just send you an email and I go, hey, look at this picture. I guarantee your children don't want to see that. Send me some Bitcoin in 24 hours or else. Yeah. And that is an inevitability.
Yeah. Yeah. No, those are some compelling reasons. I think the last two are probably, to your point, the things that, well, I think everyone sort of conceptually understands the first two, right? Like it's all about privacy. I think most people don't think about that last point, like effectively blackmail. I mean, that's sort of the, you know, and then what I learned. So I was in data privacy software sales for a long time and we would always get, as sales reps, we'd get excited about GDPR in Europe and these, you know, major privacy regulations that were passed around the globe because it meant sales for us. But the practical reality of what it meant from an economics perspective was these, to your point, these companies were spending literally millions of dollars to jump through all these nonsensical hoops. And was there potentially good intent? Sure. But I think there were too many people cheerleading these privacy regulations who, if they understood what that meant for the companies, that they've got to jump through these hoops and it's going to cost you more to use their services. I think most people would be like, I don't care enough because like I was trusting them anyway, you know, like I'd rather just keep my money, you know? So I think there are just so many unintended consequences to all of these things that people, if you're not living in that world, you just don't even think about.
Everything government does has unintended consequences. Right? Yes. Like you, to ask, voting to empower the government to make companies protect your data as though they actually could do that, first of all, mm-hmm. right? Like it's impossible. Every company is vulnerable at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. Is the same as empowering the government to feed everyone or to provide healthcare for everyone, right? It's never going to do it as well as a free market could, right? You're warping the market when you do that. If you want data privacy, stop putting your data on other people's servers. That's the market solution to the data privacy problem.
Yeah, Start9 has literally created the market solution to the data privacy.
Going to mommy government and being like, make them keep my data private is you being a lazy piece of shit. Seriously, Fuck you, because you're ruining the economy for everyone else. You're destroying, you're empowering government and fucking with my world, right? Like, just step up and do it. You want data privacy? Keep your data private. Stop being a child. And if enough people do that, then even the people who don't want that, or I shouldn't say don't want that, but don't feel competent enough or too lazy to do it, we'll do it anyway because it'll become the norm, right? It'll become so streamlined and convenient. For instance, I don't envision a future where every single individual has to run their own server. That is not necessary. All that's needed is a critical mass of people running servers. And then if you're one of the people that doesn't want to or can't or whatever, whatever your reason is, for then you just use one of those people's servers. Just like you're currently using a Google server. Like, nobody is forcing anyone to be sovereign, independent, and private. You can always choose to outsource your shit to somebody else, but you have to understand the trade-offs of that decision. You don't have to understand them. You could do it without understanding them, but you're on your own, right? If you choose to outsource your needs to another, you're trusting that person. But in our world, there would emerge a competitive marketplace of service providers, right? Where if you're somebody who doesn't want to run your own server infrastructure, you can choose. There's somebody in your neighborhood that's selling, you know, space on their server that you could use. And they have a 99.9% trust rating. They've never looked at anyone's data. You know, like, there would just emerge a marketplace for people who don't want to do it themselves. Just like there's farmers markets for people who don't grow their own food. But consolidating everything to one giant grocery chain and empowering government to oversee it ensures that the food is going to be awful. It ensures that it's going to be expensive. It ensures that there's going to be a shortage at some point. So anyway,
I like that. No, that's a great analogy. I sympathize with people who I think they unintentionally support policies that impose a cost on others. I think a lot of people just, they don't have the background to recognize what they're doing. I think that's a lot of people who champion like privacy, right? A lot of regulation. I don't sympathize with people who knowingly attempt to impose a cost on you or myself, you know, in the form of, hey, I'm unhealthy and out of shape. You subsidize my health insurance. You know, like, that's effectively what we're doing in so many realms, right? And I think that's where so with that said, I want to give you a few minutes to rant on sort of your underlying philosophy. You just sort of started it, but I've heard you on other shows just share like the sort of libertarian ideals behind Start9.
Sure.
Maybe talk a bit about that. What's sort of your fundamental worldview?
So, you know, quickly I'll just comment on what you effectively said was ignorance. Where it's like, you know, there's just this well-intended person and they just haven't read enough history, politics, economics to understand that the thing they're asking for will actually have unintended consequences that are worse than the problem that they were trying to solve in the first place. Mm-hmm. Because to be honest, that actually takes a decent amount of time and effort to get to like fully understand that cycle of that downward spiral. However, if you forgive ignorance, right, if you excuse it and sort of, I understand it's not your fault, like, if you take that approach, then it will just continue, right? Like, in other words, it's like, if some, I need an analogy that's not going to, let's say you respect the lives of all insects. Okay. You're just like, I don't want to kill insects, which I don't. Right. So this is true for me, but like they're invading my home, right? Like, let's say there's like an infestation of ants in my home. And I'm like, okay, it's not your fault. You're not attacking me. You have no knowledge whatsoever of me as a human. You don't mean malice. You're just trying to feed your family, right? I get it. Like, you're just doing what's right by you, but you invaded my home. Like, I'm sorry. It's me or you. It's got to be you. And you wipe them out. And that is, could sound extreme when applied to humans, but underneath the veils, that is the reality of things. It's like, it doesn't matter if you're doing something out of malice, incompetence, or ignorance. It doesn't matter. If the thing that you are doing is infringing upon the life and liberty of other people, you're the bad side. You gotta go. Yeah. And it's like, I might feel bad about that, but I'm gonna do it anyway, right? Like, I'm not gonna allow that. I'm not gonna allow the infestation just because it wasn't intended.
Yeah, and I think that's the reason I use the word sympathize. It's not that I think back to myself 2 years ago, I became a Bitcoiner, and that was when the rabbit hole journey started for me, and I learned a lot about all of the stuff we're talking about today. And most of the people in my life have not gone on that journey. A lot of this stuff sounds like this is what crazy people think about, and preppers and, you know, anarcho-capitalists or whatever. And so I sympathize. At the same time, it doesn't make for a better world. It makes for a more tyrannical world for us not to take these positions. And so I think what you said is completely right. So how did you, what brought you to those sorts of conclusions? Hey, just a quick break and we'll get back to the show, but I want to introduce you to our very first sponsor of the Bitcoin Way podcast, Satoshi Coffee Company. Satoshi Coffee, sats.coffee is the URL. They make high quality, fresh roasted coffee, and they even put the block number to show proof of work on each bag. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see that. I'm not a coffee snob, but I'm sort of picky about what I do enjoy. And this Satoshi blend, which is one of their more popular blends, is incredible. They also have a blend from El Salvador and a couple of others. I'd highly recommend you trying out all of them. But the cool thing about Satoshi Coffee Company is they are Bitcoin only and only accept Bitcoin as payment. And as a Bitcoin Way podcast listener, you get 6.9% off if you go to sats.coffee and enter code TBW69. Again, Satoshi Coffee Company, sats.coffee. Check them out. Support Bitcoin only companies like Satoshi Coffee Company.
So my journey, oh boy. So I went through some, we'll call them sidetracks, tangents. I mean, I went through a lot. I really tried to figure things out aggressively, primarily in my 20s, because, you know, I came out of UPenn. I went to an Ivy League university. It's one of the, you know, the Northeast elite schools in the US. And it is everything people fear them to be. Those institutions are breeding grounds of elitist socialism. You know, they really do pump out powerful, intelligent collectivists. You know, all
was that you? Was that you at one point?
It tried to be. They tried to, and I, being a thorough intellectual, at least I try to be, I have to assess all possibilities, right? I don't just want to blindly believe anything. So I tried to like make sense of it, but something was never quite sitting right. It never quite added up. But I mean, I was raised with a, like, in a family that never talked about politics, never talked about economics, never talked about history. Like, the world was your work and your family was your joy and you played sports and you, like, it was all good stuff, but there was no higher perspective, no historical, political, or economic perspective offered to me in my childhood. And so the only perspective I got was from the public institutions, the public school that I went to, and then the elite university that I went to. And so the only thing I ever heard was, check the left side of the voting ballot. That came from my mother. You know, check the left side. You don't need to know who's on it. We vote Democrat. And then I go to public school and they teach you sharing is caring and all the rest. And then I go to university and they teach you Keynesian economics, period. There is no other perspective. I never had another perspective, but it never quite sat right. And I was getting increasingly angry as like a youth. I was just like an angry 21-year-old. And in retrospect, I know why. It's because I was starving for some truth and reality and was not being offered to me, at least in this, the political, economic, historical perspective. However, I did come across some gems on my own, and it wasn't until after I graduated, shockingly, like really after I graduated college, was the first time I'd ever heard of Ron Paul. And he became my entry point to the entire freedom philosophy and world and Austrian economics and all the rest. I like fell in love with Ron Paul. I read his books. In 2012, I was campaigning on his behalf. I was helping for a brief stint produce some videos that were helping with the campaign. And I just sort of like went down the libertarian rabbit hole. And what was interesting is I had discovered truth, but it was conflicting with my prior learnings and understandings. And so I sort of had to get to the bottom of it. I had to prove to myself that this was correct holistically from every angle, that there was no crack in the foundation that was going to be like, oh, well, that's why it doesn't work and why we need socialism, right? So I was like desperately seeking why socialism could work and desperately seeking why libertarianism couldn't work. Because one or the other, if I could prove either of those, then I would know the other one was the way to go, right? And I shouldn't say libertarianism, it's capitalism, right? Like, let's be real. It's socialism versus capitalism, really. So anyway, to disprove socialism or to try to prove why socialism could work, I did a final sort of journey. I was like, I'm going to go see. And so I went to the socialist capital of the world, the one that from my life was the place where if I was going to find an example of socialism working, it was going to be here. So I went to Israel. I went there on a one-way ticket and I vowed not to leave until I had some answers. Because I was raised Jewish as well. So in my mind, Israel was like, it's openly and obviously socialist, but like it's working, right? It's like one of those good socialist places, right? It's based in democracy. It's whatever. So I go over there and I just winged it. I had a backpack and I figured it out as I went. And I realized that country is a gigantic military base, period. That's it. Israel's a military base, the whole country. And everyone is conscripted minus the religious Orthodox. And so I was like, oh, so like military is at the center of Israeli and socialist culture, which sort of makes sense. So I may as well figure that out. So I joined the military. I went and volunteered for the IDF to get inside and see what's what. So they sent me off to a base, multiple, in fact. I base hopped for a couple months and talked with 19-year-old children, soldiers, about their childhood and their lives and what it's like and how do they feel about conscription, and all the while I'm helping clean tanks and all the rest. And it was a really interesting and fruitful experience. During that time do we have time right now?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. During that time was the Arab Spring. This is when I was over there. It was in the heart of like Mubarak getting ousted in Egypt. So the whole region was like in revolution mode. And Israel wanted theirs too. Because one of the first things I found when I got over there was that the average person, just pluck a person off the streets of Israel, they love America, right? Not because America supports Israel, but because America is free in their minds. They're like, mm-hmm. We want what you have. We want freedom. These were like genuine, good, amazing people. And they were just like, fuck socialism. Yeah. We're sick of this shit. We just want to be free. And that's one of the first things you find out. And and they wanted their revolution. They saw what was happening in the surrounding Arab countries. And it kicked off. Ironically, there was an Orthodox Jew who walked into a grocery store and went to buy cottage cheese. Cottage cheese is like a staple over there. It's every meal. It's cottage cheese is everywhere. It's people think it's hummus. It's not. It's cottage cheese. That's the staple of the diet. And it was like super expensive. Everything is expensive. Everything is so expensive over there. You can barely afford to live. And it was so expensive that he goes, I'm done. I'm not buying cottage cheese until the price comes down. I'm boycotting. I'm striking against cottage cheese. So Israel has one dairy manufacturer. Okay. Like government subsidized everything. Like they have one dairy company and the price of cottage cheese was high. So everyone latched onto this and they were like, screw it. We won't buy cottage cheese either. The whole country striked against cottage cheese. And so what did the government do? They came in and Netanyahu, you know, he says, well, I today have spoken with the dairy company. I forget their name. He goes, I've spoken with the dairy company and I've told them to lower the price immediately, or we're going to open the border to imports and competition. We're going to subject them to competition if they don't lower the price.
God forbid.
So overnight, the price collapses. And everybody in the country looked at each other and went,
we could do that?
Power. Power. Wow, there's power in striking. There's power in opting out. And so what did they do? They went right for the heart. The most expensive thing in Israel by far that bankrupts every family and individual is housing, mm-hmm. because there's not a lot of land.
Yeah,
that's kind of the whole point. There's not a lot of land. It's extremely expensive to get a roof over your head in Israel. And so they go, screw it. We won't live in our homes until the price comes down. Let's do the same thing we did with cottage cheese. And so everyone got tents and pitched tents all over the country. Everyone moved out of their apartments and homes. I shouldn't say everyone. This was mostly a youth movement. And the streets of Tel Aviv were just lined with tents. And so everyone moves into these tents. And I was like, sign me up. So I went and got a tent. And I'm living on the streets of Tel Aviv, showering at the showers at the ocean on the beach, and eating and brushing my teeth at McDonald's down the street for weeks. I'm living in this tent and talking with everybody. And again, what I realize is that I was like, okay, maybe this is how it works, right? To keep the context here, like this was a study for me. Like I was over there trying to prove that this form of society and governance is correct and works. And so it's working. It's like, wow, we're like, they're like affecting change. Like maybe Netanyahu's going to get ousted. I mean, there were marches through Tel Aviv and the tens of thousands of people with giant balloons up in the air of like Netanyahu riding a pig and just like, we want him out. Like the people were like done. And I'm meanwhile talking with family back home and I go, isn't this crazy? Do you guys see what's happening? And they go, what do you mean?
They have no idea.
I go, what? I was like, this isn't on the news? There's a fucking revolution taking place in Israel right now. It didn't even make American news. So I'm like, okay, well, fine. So I'm still doing my thing. And eventually, you know, the tent protest was continuing and there were some negotiations going back and forth with the government apparently. But I needed some housing. I was getting dirty. It was not sustainable the way I was living. So I called up my representative in the IDF and was like, hey, I need a bed and some 3 meals a day. Like, send me, you know. And she goes, all right, so head down to this base in the south, this Air Force base in the deep south, like right at the border of Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Jordan, right at that intersection. And so I'm like, all right. So I go to the bus station, I get on this bus and we're headed south. Near the tip, the southern tip, right? Getting from the Egyptian border to the Jordanian border is like a couple miles. It's like this tiny little sliver of land that you're driving down. We're driving down the Egyptian border. And suddenly our driver gets off the road and turns into the desert. Just leaves the road, goes into the desert, and beelines it for the Jordanian border through desert, through like rocks. And very calmly, it's just like, the bus in front of us has just been bombed. And we are heading for the safer border because they came over from Egypt. And so this extremely tense desert ride to the Jordanian border, and then ultimately to a military base right down at that southern tip. What happened, it was the end of my journey. I realized what the ultimate face of reality was, which was as soon as this attack took place, okay, the second this bus was bombed, and there was like another shooting down there as well. It was like two simultaneous kind of like, you know, minor attacks. Like a couple people died. It was a horrible thing, but it wasn't like this huge thing. It was just a couple little attacks in a very isolated region. The entire country, all of Israel, overnight, all the tents vanished. Everyone snapped to attention, reported to their bases, and loaded their guns. The entire country is an army. The entire country is a military base. And they were prepared to fight in the middle of a revolution that was taking place. In a matter of hours, it was like, done. The revolution is over, and we're back to fighting our enemy. And I was like, oh God, that's what is underneath it all. That's the reality of socialism. That's the reality of collectivism. It's ultimately just force. It's ultimately just violence. And so I got my answer. That was it. I was done. I was like, okay, fuck this place, right? Like, not, I shouldn't say that, okay? Because it's a nuanced sort of lesson that I got out of this. The people are amazing. I loved the people that I met. They just want to be Americans. But what I realized is that a socialist military form of governance never permits freedom. Now, I don't know, right? I'm not willing to even speculate on whether or not the attacks that took place were opportunistic.
That was my question. Yeah.
Ultimately, it doesn't really matter, to be honest. Like, it kind of does in how you might feel about it, but in the outcome, it doesn't really matter. The reality is
you needed to know.
The reality is that it was used. It was used to the extreme by the incumbent powers to end a nationwide protest.
Yeah.
And so I was like, that's it. I was home 2 weeks later. And I had my answer. And I have always had a soft spot for the people of that country because I know what they're going through and I know that this isn't what they want. But I wasn't going to try to mimic it here. So I went to the other extreme. And then what happened was, you know, I realized Ron Paul was right about everything. And he's a hero of mine and he will be an American hero in the history books. And then I found Ayn Rand and I realized that Ayn Rand was actually the philosophic sort of precursor and basis for Ron Paul. Even knowingly, like Ron Paul, like read Ayn Rand and that's how he became Ron Paul, right? Like she provided the philosophic moral framework for libertarianism. A lot of libertarians either don't know that or don't like to admit that, but it is true. She's the godmother of it all. And she, in fact, provided the philosophic and moral basis for the original principles of the founding fathers of the United States. They understood much of the politics and economics of how to establish a great nation, but they actually were lacking to a degree, at least not as individuals, but as informal kind of writing and literature, they were lacking the sort of moral and philosophic justification for the country that they had created, which actually left the door open for it to become compromised, right? A house lacking a foundation will eventually get wobbly. Well, Ayn Rand provided that foundation a couple of centuries later and too late. But learning the politics and economics from Ron Paul, learning the philosophy, and by that I mean metaphysics, epistemology, ethics from Ayn Rand, I sort of was starting to build a very sound philosophic and political base of libertarianism and capitalism. Then I found Bitcoin. And what happened was when I had that full base of Ayn Rand at the base, Ron Paul as sort of the next layer, I was actually quite depressed because the only thing I could conclude was that we're all fucked. I was like, oh no, like that's the right way to do things. That's the truth and goodness. But look at what we've created. It's a monster. How does good win? I didn't actually see a path to victory. All I saw was a tragedy, right? I saw a like, oh no, the good guy's going to die type of scenario. And I didn't know how to fight back. And then I discovered Bitcoin. And it just so happens, and this was pure coincidence, that I discovered Bitcoin at the same time or slightly after I began teaching myself how to code. And so I like, it was this massive inflection point in my life where it's like learning how to code and discovering Bitcoin made me realize that that is the angle. I was like, oh, that's how we can fight back. That's the underbelly of the beast. That's its flaw and vulnerability. It will self-destruct through people opting out, right? So that became the basis. It's the whole cottage cheese revolution. That became the basis of my battle plan. It became the basis of how you fight back. And to do it morally, by the way, is that you don't actually need to attack. You don't need to fight back. You just need to leave. Just stop buying it, right? Opt out. Let the damn thing only survives because it feeds off of your money, your energy,
participation,
your productive capacity, your compliance. You feed this beast. Everyone feeds it by continuing to make that decision. And so you just leave from every way that you can, in every way that you can, right? Leaving physically, quite frankly, is not really an option for a lot of people because it's just not an option. It's hard to do. It's, you know, it's expensive. Where are you going to go? Show me the free corner of the world, right? Like,
yeah,
like it used to be here. People flocked here for centuries. Where do you go next? Mars? I mean, sure, sign me up, but like, it's not going to happen in time, right? You know, like, so there is nowhere left to run in the physical world. If you're rich enough and you're, you know, lucky enough, you can find a little enclave and sort of hide out, but there's more effective ways to leave. Remove your money from the system. Stop using the dollar, use Bitcoin. Remove your data from the system. Stop using third-party servers, use your own, right? Grow your own food, raise your own kids, opt out of the school system, opt out of the supermarkets. Just stop using the damn system. Take care of yourself. Encourage your friends and family members to take care of themselves. And what happens to the system is it just starts to convulse, right? From lack of food, it just starves. And yeah, it's going to kick, right? It's going to kick and thrash. And so you need to be prepared to deal with that backlash as this worsens, as more and more people opt out. You need to be aware that there are individuals within that system that will not go without a fight. And so be prepared to deal with that. Make sure that you're not exposed unreasonably on any front. And so that's it. That's my whole philosophy of like, I'm a capitalist, basically a libertarian, though I do not agree with or associate with the Libertarian Party in any strict sense, because I don't think the Libertarian Party strictly stands for libertarianism. But philosophically speaking, I'm a libertarian. And I believe that the way of implementing a libertarian-based and capitalist society is for individuals to opt out of the socialist society at every opportunity until it starves and dies, and to do so in a principled, uncompromising way. And so where Start9 fits into that equation is I have used that understanding of the world and my development skills, as well as my partners and the other members of Start9, to offer people a means, a practical, achievable means of opting out of the matrix, right? The digital cage that is the cloud-based internet.
Man, I can't wait to pull some clips from that rant, man. That was good.
It was long.
I think you pulled that together very nicely. The backstory is fascinating. That's unbelievable, the lengths to which you went to find truth. But I think that final conclusion is so important. And you know, you hear like opt out, like it's a meme in Bitcoin, right? But I think you brought some clarity to what that really means. It's like you can just remove yourself from each of these different components. Homeschool your kids, grow your own food, shake your rancher's hand. Like a lot of these memes that we have in Bitcoin that are like, oh, that seems like a good thing to do. But really, it's almost as important that you're not doing the other thing.
Yeah.
Because that's how it starves itself. And yeah. And we don't, you know, it's yeah, you just you allow the beast to self-destruct.
Yeah.
And you don't have to pay the price in the way that many people will if you've removed yourself.
And from it's that nonviolent. Order. It's legal and it's moral.
Mm. Yeah.
It is the most effective. It's not only, it's also the most effective.
Yeah.
Like it check, 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 right? It's usually striking hurts the strikers. Take a look at like labor movements against companies in the past, right? Like you need your paycheck, right? You're living paycheck to paycheck. And so you go on strike and now it becomes, who can last longer? Can the company survive without its workforce, or can the workforce survive without its company? It becomes this like, you know, the picket line. And if you cross, you're a traitor and all the rest, right? This is the easiest strike in the history of strikes. Because when you strike, you actually benefit. Your life gets better as a result of striking. So it's like, this should be a wiping of the table. This should be the easiest battle and revolution that has ever taken place. It should be. If people understood, right? It's a matter of education. If people understood the battleground is such that if I stay, I get continually harmed, stolen from, spied on, censored. Like if I stay, all these horrible things happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm feeding the master that is doing these horrible things to me. I stay and I get beat and I provide the food. Okay. I leave. I eat whatever I want. I provide my own food. And the old master starves to death. It's like win-win. There's no trade-off here. The trade-off is a degree of self-esteem and responsibility. That's it. Well, what's the catch? You have to be an adult. That's the catch.
Yeah. Yeah.
You have to grow up and take responsibility for your life. And if that's too hard for you, you deserve to be a slave and worse.
Yeah. And I think too, there are so many people who I think are lacking fulfillment today and in putting themselves in a position to take on that responsibility, I think would give them the fulfillment that they crave.
Yes.
And like, I think it's not even a trade-off. It only sounds like a trade-off because we're so used to this lethargic, lazy, you know, Netflix junk food lifestyle.
Sure.
Right. But like the minute you abandon that, that's the moment that you begin to experience like the fulfillment of what your life could be.
Yeah. But that is a habit and it is chemically reinforced, right? We're not just talking about some decision here. We're talking about addiction. We're talking about mental illness. You know, we have a sick society. I don't use that term in some derogatory sense like a lot of people do. I mean, like, if I used it in the physical sense, everyone would just be like, yep, yep. Like, do we have a physically sick society? Absolutely. Nobody can argue that because you can see it. But what I'm saying is that there is an equal amount of emotional, spiritual, and mental sickness as well. And that's really hard to overcome. It's really hard to get healthy, right? Because you get caught in this pattern, and breaking out of it requires not just effort. It requires a degree of self-esteem. You have to believe that you're worth it. Most people will not change their lives for the better. And they may actually lean on the idea that it's too hard to do, that like, that's, you know, too hard, but that's actually them doing mental gymnastics. The real reason is that they don't feel that they deserve it. The real reason that people don't get healthy physically and mentally is because they believe they're a low down, dirty, viral human infesting this earth, destroying its environments, ruining its climate, right? They believe that they're a dirty, sinful being. And when you believe that, you're not going to get healthy.
Yeah.
Right? Getting healthy requires a heroic and glorious view of humanity and human nature and of your own existence. Okay? If you think about humans as being these sluggish, viral parasites of the planet, how are you going to feel good about yourself? You are one of those things. But that is the pervasive perspective of humanity, human nature. If you ask anyone, go to some college kid and be like, are humans good? Are humans good for this planet? Are they inherently good? And no, of course not. It's not what you've been taught.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you got to fix that perspective. You have to believe that humans deserve this universe, that we deserve, you know, that we are the pinnacle of what nature and God have produced, right? Like, how long did it take to bring us about? You think that's an accident, right? First, there was stars and energy and dust, and now there's humans. We're the reason, we're the result. It's a giant universal conspiracy to create beings of higher consciousness, and we are the highest that we are aware of. We're the most glorious thing in the universe. We're more glorious than the stars, than the galaxies, than all of it combined, because they're all just the engines for creating us. And so you have to have that perspective in order to wake up in the morning and fight for your right to live and to live happily. And we don't. We all think we're shit.
Yeah, it's a trap. It's a trap. And the incentives are broken. And it makes a lot of sense in light of the system in which we exist, that we've been led to this. I mean, it's the classic, show me the incentives and I'll show you, you know, the result, or, you know, whatever the people say it in different ways. Hey, so first of all, I hope we entertained people enough in the first half that they listen to the second half. Cause I think the last, you know, 30, 40 minutes of this are really important. So hopefully we keep them hanging on. Two final questions for you. One of them is one that I haven't asked anyone that I want to start asking. And that's just or if you've got a couple of book recommendations, non-Bitcoin. I mean, I think the Bitcoin standard, like, we're going to get a lot of that otherwise, but, and I think we'll get the sovereign individual. We'll get a lot of similar ones, but anything non-Bitcoin specific, what's a book or two you'd recommend?
My God. I read prolifically.
Okay.
I have a ton.
Give a couple.
I mean, I'll come up with a couple, but I guarantee you there's going to be an equal number that I don't mention that are just as good. So I'll just cite the first couple that come to mind. So I'll work from the bottom up. Okay. So The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand is a wonderful piece of fiction that really embodies the meaning of her philosophy. Doesn't spell it out in perfect terms by design, but it embodies it. It leaves you with the emotion of it. Atlas Shrugged is the book that spells it out. In fact, it spells it out over 1,100 pages with a mallet to the head, because she wrote that book very angrily because people didn't get it from The Fountainhead. So she was like, oh, you want me to spell it out for you? Here you go. But the combination of those two books, The Fountainhead being the better piece of literature, right, being the better read, and Atlas Shrugged being much more of the treaty, the treatise based on it. So those two for sure. All of her nonfiction is also wonderful. Mostly I read fiction, by the way. I mean, I've read a ton of nonfiction, but I believe that the real value is in fiction, right? I believe that that wisdom arises from experience and storytelling and, you know, experience. And if you can't experience something yourself, then the best alternative is to read about it. That is the best way to garner experience that you yourself either have not yet or cannot get. And that that is far more valuable than knowledge, than information. Information is cheap and almost worthless. ChatGPT knows everything. Google knows everything. Like, you can look stuff up on demand, but real experience and wisdom come from, you know, real wisdom comes from experience. And so reading fiction is far more valuable to a person than nonfiction. But anyway, so what's a couple other fiction ones? If you want, I love historical fiction biographies, technically nonfiction, but it's still a narrative, so it's the same for me.
Yeah.
The Power Broker is a very little known and incredibly well-written book. If you are looking for the sort of inside perspective on how government bureaucracies work, like really like kind of the way that certain personalities operate within a bureaucracy in order to, you know, achieve their own personal goals, read The Power Broker. The Power Broker is the biography of Robert Moses, who very few people know that he basically built New York City's entire transportation infrastructure. All the bridges, all the tunnels, all the highways, all the state parks, all the inner city parks. He, more than any person, if you were to just look at New York City from a bird's eye view, his name is everywhere. He built that city. And he did it on the backs of everyone and for his own very personal motivations, and caused immeasurable suffering and damage in doing it. And he did it by getting his hands within the proper levers of government and just wreaking havoc. It is an incredible book. A piece of fiction there. Any biographies by Walter Isaacson are wonderful. So the Benjamin Franklin, Albert Einstein, Steve Jobs, he's got one called The Innovators. There's a bunch. Walter Isaacson is an incredible biographer. So if you're looking for like some great people from history and to learn about their lives and to learn from their experiences, read Walter Isaacson books. So science fiction is my main category. Fucking love science fiction. I read it probably 4 to 1, 5 to 1 to any other category. So some of my favorites are The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert Heinlein. This is the story of revolution. It is the moon has become a sort of working prison colony of Earth, and the moon rebels against Earth. And it's a battle. It's a war. And it's gritty and it's awesome. And it involves like advanced AI, and it's actually quite prescient. So Moon is a Harsh Mistress is a wonderful one. Dune, amazing book. Dune 2, the movie, just came out. Awesome. I can't believe how good they did. Actually, I was blown away because I did not have high expectations, but it's great. But the book is, precious. It's an amazing book. A huge one, if you're looking for like a huge, epic, sort of heroic human story that tells the entire sort of history of primitive man to humans ruling the universe, read Battlefield Earth. Battlefield Earth is L. Ron Hubbard's magnum opus other than Scientology, right? So Scientology is like what he's really known for, like inventing this religion. But he was actually just a great science fiction writer. And Scientology is a giant work of science fiction that he claimed to be true. And, you know, people believed it. But most of his other works of science fiction, he didn't claim to be true. He just claimed them to be works of science fiction. And Battlefield Earth is his like greatest work. It's absolutely incredible. It follows this main character called Johnny Good Boy Tyler. And he's like literally a primitive human living in the Rocky Mountains, distant in the future after Earth has been conquered by an alien species. And we don't even know about the past. And he's literally like this, you know, loincloth tribal human. And he like gradually learns the truth about what happened in the past while simultaneously like, you know, learning about new technologies and ultimately battling the aliens that conquered us. And it's just this huge book that traces primitive man all the way to man, the hero. The Red Rising series is unbelievable. You can do no better if you're looking for something amazing to read, like page turning, can't put it down. Like I waited on pins and needles for months for the next book to come out and crush it out in one day when it did. Like it's that good. Masterpiece of modern science fiction. And it's not done yet. The seventh book is still being written. So that's probably, you know, possibly the most invigorating reads I've ever had. The Foundation series is wonderful and it's a classic, though it's not my favorite. I think the book that may have hit me hardest early on, I haven't reread it, so I don't actually know where it fits into like the list of my favorites, because at the time it was my favorite, but then I've read so many good books since then that I would need to reread it to see how it compares. But Gone with the Wind is amazing. Gone with the Wind was the easy answer for me for many years. When somebody's like, what's your favorite book? I just said Gone with the Wind. It's my favorite book for many years. And it might still be. I need to reread it to see how good it really is, 20 years later or 15 years later. But like, incredible book. It's a masterpiece of American literature, possibly the best ever written. So Gone with the Wind really is a like user manual in a sense on how to survive a war. It's like people think about Gone with the Wind as like, oh, it's a love story between like Scarlet and Rhett, right? Because they made a movie off of it that really focused on the love aspect. Well, it is a love story and love is an important part of life. But the backdrop of this love story is the Civil War. And it's like gritty as shit. Like people, this is not some like lighthearted love story. This is like, it's called Gone with the Wind because it focuses on Scarlet and the South primarily and their lifestyle. Right. She was a princess, right? By like, in a sort of realistic sense, because it was a kingdom of sorts. And she was a daughter of a massive wealthy plantation owner. And the South had this way of life. And then it was like gone with the wind, like the Civil War hit and like this entire way of life and her position in that society was just blown away and confronted with this deeper level of reality of human existence. Namely war. And so it follows her sort of coming to terms with this deeper reality and figuring out how to navigate it, largely at the guidance of Rhett Butler, who understood this reality before the war broke out, was prepared for it and thrived in it. And then it's the story of them sort of, you know, getting through it together. And it's just this incredible book. I'm going to leave out so many amazing books, but there's a nice short list.
Yeah.
Pretty much everything I just named is over 1,000 pages, by the way. I love big stories. I love big epics that like take their time to create characters and unfold a story because anything, otherwise it's rushed.
That's great. Hey, you have time for one last question. This is maybe a shorter one. Just any Bitcoin predictions, thoughts on the next 12 to 18 months, what you are anticipating?
I assume you mean price.
Well, price. I mean, we've had some interesting developments the last week or two with some arrests. And are we at the, you know, then they fight you stage? And if so, how does that play out? Price predictions are interesting too.
I don't know if we're quite at they fight you stage yet. I think they're still trying to find a way to co-opt it. Right. So what they're doing is they're fighting the uncooptable aspects of Bitcoin, right? Bitcoin could be extremely useful to the state if they control it. It's a public ledger, right? It's actually like the state's like ideal way of tracking money. But there are certain aspects of it that don't fit that. And so need to be fought off. But largely, I think they're still in the phase of trying to like bring it within the fold to make Bitcoin part of the system. And time will tell if that succeeds or not. I'm optimistic, but I am not a historical determinist. I don't think that it is bound to win. I don't think that it is necessary that it wins. It absolutely could get co-opted or destroyed, but I don't think it will. I'm optimistic. I do think we'll have some turbulence. That's sort of an easy thing to say. I can't be wrong there. We will have turbulence. More people will get arrested. Price will go up. Price will go down. But I'm optimistic. I personally hold Bitcoin, and I build on Bitcoin, and I build technology around Bitcoin, and I encourage others to adopt and help. But yeah, I have no idea what the price is going to do.
Yeah, I think you just gave the only correct answer that you could possibly give.
I have no idea.
We don't. Well, Matt, hey, I can't thank you enough, man. This has been, I can't wait to pull some clips from this, because I think you hit on some gems, and it's a message a lot of people need to hear. It's something that I think, like when I think about my own friends and family, the people around me, it's like, man, I wish I could get them to understand some of those truths that you dropped in here. So I really appreciate your time. I love what you're working on at Start Nine. I think I'm going to probably be a client again and get another device for some of these other projects I have, because it's time I step up my game.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate all that. Thanks for having me on.
You bet, man. Take care. Have a good one. And we'll talk again soon.
All right, you too. See ya.
And that's a wrap. Again, I appreciate you taking time to listen to this conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I think Matt is awesome and just dropped some unbelievable truth bombs for us here. By the way, I forgot to ask him for a handoff. He was in a bit of a rush heading off to a meeting, so I dropped the ball. But just check out Start9. If you go to start9.com, you've got some hardware that you need to consider buying, because then on the back end, you've got open source software you can download to take sovereignty over your digital life. And you can follow Matt on X. It's @_MattHill_. And of course, if you need help with Bitcoin self-custody, come talk to us at The Bitcoin Way. You can find us on Twitter, X, whatever, @TheBitcoinWay_. Or you can go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast to schedule a free consultation. And if you want to connect with me, ask questions, reach out, give suggestions, feedback on the show, of course, I would love to hear from you. I'm on X as well, @TheOtherMJordan. And you can check out my free weekly newsletter on Bitcoin basics, blackhatbitcoin.substack.com. Again, I appreciate you being here. Until next time, this is Michael Jordan signing off.